To order. Good morning. Wednesday, May 25th. We were supposed to start at 8:30. We're close. Thank you, committee, for being here. I see Senator Ringo is here in the room. Would you like to come up and we'll open your...
Sure.
You're here on SJM-4?
Right now.
Well, we'll open a public hearing on SJM-4. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair of Committee. For the record, State Senator Charlie Ringo. This is the only joint memorial I've ever done because memorials are generally considered of marginal value. And Senator Gary George and I both feel strongly about this issue, and it has to do with public access to public lands. There used to be a program called the Fee Demo Program that was run by Congress that charged citizens to use federal lands, both BLM land and Department of Ag Forest land, for recreation purposes. That was later substituted for the Federal Lands Recreation Act, and that's the law that Congress recently passed. And I have a tremendous interest in ensuring public access to public lands. And when people are charged, and whether it's $5 to go for a hike or a $30 annual fee, it reduces access. And to me, that's the wrong direction. One of the things that people can argue whether our federal lands are managed well for natural resource purposes, this isn't that issue. This is, shall we encourage or shall we discourage the public from recreating our public lands? I think this sends an important message that we don't want to discourage that public access. That's what this is about.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Any questions for the senator? I think we all do memorials.
You know, this passed in 2001. Representative Tim Knope sponsored a very similar memorial, not for this act, but for the fee demo program, as it was stated at that time. So me, Tim Knope, Gary George, we're all together on this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Dave Kelsey. Did I have that right? He wanted to testify on this. He's the only other person I have signed up. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Chair, members of the committee. I'm a public recreationalist. I need you to support this.
For the record, we need you to state your name.
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Dave Kelsey. I'm a public recreationalist. I'm also a small-scale gold miner. Hmm. This weekend, we're all going on vacation, all of us. I have to tailor my vacation to where I have to pay or I can't pay. This doesn't make sense to us. We're the members of the public. We already pay our taxes. The fees don't go where they need to go. It costs too much to collect these fees in the first place. Most of the money doesn't ever get there. 3 weeks ago, the Forest Service said all over the news they're going to close places. What's left to go to? If we need the money, let's ask Congress to fund it. Or let's find another way to do this. But we need this supported. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kelsey? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Joint Memorial 4? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 4 and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 4.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Joint Memorial 4 be sent to the floor with the be adopted.
Thank you. So moved. Yeah. Just kidding. We have a motion from Representative Boquist to move Senate Joint Memorial to the floor and be adopted. Do I have any objections? Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hatch?
Aye.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Chair votes aye. Having received votes, Senate Joint Memorial number 4 is moved to the House. 4 would be adopted. And Representative Roblin, would you like to be the carrier?
I would, unless people think this should be on the consent. Can it be?
I would think a memorial.
To carry so we can talk about it.
Yeah, right.
I'd be glad to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Memorials are special.
Okay. The only hearing they get.
And I'm doing one today.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back to Senate Bill 184. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 184. Patrick, do you want to tell us?
Hello, Madam Chair.
Senate Bill 184 revises language in statutes relating to regulating with the registration and distribution of fertilizer. Agricultural Amendment, I'm not sure what that is, agricultural mineral and lime products, deletes references to statements, places them with references to semi-annual tonnage reports, and makes changes to circumstances under which a civil penalty may be assessed by the State Department of Agriculture and defines certain terms. This bill has no fiscal or revenue impact and was passed through the Senate on a 25-0 vote.
Thank you very much. We have Chuck Craig and Matt Haynes here from the ODA, Oregon Department of Ag. If you'd like to come forward, good morning. Good morning. Hi there.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Chuck Craig. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Agriculture, and with me is Matt Haynes from our department, who is our lead fertilizer specialist. Thanks for hearing Senate Bill 184. This is a housekeeping bill that the department is bringing forward to improve the clarity and consistency in Oregon's fertilizer law. Laws, and it does not have it has very little what I would call substantive changes in the law, and we've provided two pieces of written testimony. One is just a very brief overall summary of what the bill does, and the other is a list of the line-by-line changes in the bill, divided into those that the department proposed as well as those that legislative council did as a matter of modernizing the style and English usage in the bill. The bill does three things. It creates a consistent definition of distribute throughout the different chapters in our fertilizer statute so that we have that consistency. It clarifies the conditions under which the maximum civil penalty can be imposed under the law. And third, it It creates a level of activity, de minimis activity, below which no fee is charged. And so we'd be happy to answer questions, go through the changes line by line if you like, or whatever your pleasure is, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you. Did you want to testify anything or just answer any questions? How's the committee feel about it? Do you have any questions or Representative Bocus? Yes.
My only question is, since, you know, obviously there are stakeholders, you know, training for cattlemen, the farmers, everything else, and did the department consult with them? And I'm assuming 25-0, they must.
We did, and the industry testified in favor on the Senate side.
Thank you, Madam.
And there's one other amendment that's coming to this bill. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that right now. But.
Well, we're not going to go to work session on this bill today. Representative Sumner?
Can you tell me, sir, if this in any way impairs the ability of private property owners, you know, amateur gardeners or whatever, from purchasing or paying an additional fee to buy any of these elements?
Madam Chair, Rep. Sumner, no, but it does. It has kind of a right to know component where the private landowner can find out exactly what is in the product, because there's a process for that the companies have to submit analyses to the department. So I would say everything for the small landowner is positive about what this bill and the modifications that the 2001 session made to the fertilizer statutes. They're all in favor of the user.
Thank you.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that you opened the can of worms.
Yeah. Had to happen.
You said there's labeling, and I agree with that thought in here, but can you address the issue? This isn't going to restrict the state of Oregon with some products because manufacturers now simply won't ship it to Oregon?
I'm not aware that that's happened. Perhaps Matt can answer that.
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist. It's happened only in terms of one product that I know of, and that was for an excess of arsenic. that was established back in 2002. So this has no bearing on that whatsoever.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I don't see any other further questions, but we are going to have an amendment to this in the next day or so. So maybe people can read over this, and then if there's other questions, we can have them back, and you can see the amendments. I haven't seen them yet either. So.
Okay.
If that'll work, that's
sure.
Best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 184? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 184. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 191. Patrick, do you want to tell us about that one?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 191 expands the membership of the Sustainability Board from 8 members to 10. It specifies that the additional members are to represent agricultural and forest land interests. It extends the sunset for the board, or for the Oregon Sustainability Act, rather, to January 2nd, 2012, and specifies that monies remaining in the Sustainability Board fund after that date be transferred to the general fund for general government expenses. This measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, which these days means a referral to the Committee on Budget. Of course, the Senate vote on this measure was 20-5.
Okay.
And I can provide members if you would like with the vote sheet on that.
Okay. I think if they have any questions on that, they can find out from you. And we also had an amended fiscal.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. Yes, we did. The fiscal impact that was considered by the Senate was revised. We received that yesterday, and I believe we distributed that. Janita distributed that. It would have been for that, and she had sent it around. It was highlighted in pink. It's also in your packets. The revised fiscal impact for it is still a white sheet, but the effective portions of it are in the third and second to last paragraphs. The Legislative Fiscal Office now estimates this will have a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you. Now, David, did you want to come up and
sure.
I have three people signed up, but I didn't have you. So, do you want to come first?
Can I come up with
sure.
And
sure. And Bob Refine? Yeah. Hi. You want to come up too?
Sure.
Great.
Get it over with.
Sounds treacherous in here.
In a good way.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, I didn't actually sign up because I wanted to let these folks do most of the talking, and I think the changes to what the legislation will do is radically already set out, but it just expands the size of the board by two members, makes clear that the board is going to have agricultural and timber sector representatives, and it expands the timing on the board by 6 years. The board already has gone through some changes.
For the record, you need to state.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dave Vantoff from the governor's office.
Thank you.
The board already has added an agricultural representative, Tracy Liske, from Klamath Falls, but this makes it clear that there will always be someone from the ag sector represented. And there's also a liaison to the board right now that OFIC and OSWA had identified as someone that they would like to be participating in board activities. His name's Tom Nygren, and he's been participating for several months on board activities, and likely would be the person added to the board if the board expanded. So I'm going to let these folks talk about kind of what the board's been doing and
okay.
From their perspective. And if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer any.
Thank you. Any questions? week, I guess, until the panel's done. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. In the handout that was circulated to you regarding the report, that you'll find, in, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, there's a narrative in there that talks about 20 agencies that were chosen to be part of the original sustainability focus for the state of Oregon under this program. I wanted to just share some thoughts with you and just let you know, as an agency who is one of those 20 participating agencies, how I believe it has worked within the very short period of time that we've been actually up and running, and what it, I think, has an opportunity to bring the state of Oregon as those 20 agencies progress and other agencies could be added on, including agencies specifically as the two seats are being added on, broaden the scope of sustainability. My agency, obviously, generally people think of sustainability being a natural resource or an environmental issue. You know, it really spans out much further than that. My agency, obviously, housing is neither one of those in the truest sense of the words, but we have a community investment, which is a sustainable investment for communities. And so we need to be just as mindful of where we put developments, how that affects the long-term viability of community, what can we do to sustain that community so we don't have towns becoming less located around the state of Oregon, or going up for sale signs for towns. How do we bring our resources to make sure the communities have that viability or sustainability? So we've learned a lot from that. But as a member of one of the reviewing panels for the 20 groups, I've had the opportunity, and actually a very eye-opening opportunity, to be part of a small group of people who review the quarterly reports as these agencies are making their headway as to what they've chosen to talk about on their sustainability activities. And it has been both enlightening for me, but also always allowed me to see where there might be some opportunities to partner up with other agencies where I didn't have really a common sense of some of their activities. Government is like any other agency. We're a lot of departments, but we generally don't have a real sense of some of the day-to-day activities. And so I have found some amazing partnership opportunities because just of this mere discussion on sustainability by probing or reading these reports from other agencies. And I think as this gets more traction over time, agencies will be both better positioned, have a better understanding of government, and deliver sustainability commodities to the state of Oregon and to the people of Oregon, but make themselves a more sustainable entity within themselves. Everything from, as I said, natural resource issues to streamlining for government purposes for community strengths and building over the time. And so I think that's what I've seen in this program. It's been very, I think, very rewarding. And to the agencies that I do the review for, so far they've all been very positive to have the reviews done by their peers and take that information back to improve their programs as time goes on. So, again, from a perspective of somebody who participates, I think it's been a well-received new entry into how to do government at a higher level.
Great. Thank you. Bill?
Representative Smith, members of the committee, I'm Bill Blosser, a member of the Sustainability Board. Bob ably covered one of the things that the board has been working on over the last 2 years, which is the sustainability programs within the state agencies. I'd like to talk to you about the other part of what the board has been doing, and in many ways has occupied as large a period of part of its time as the other side. I think by way of introduction, I would say that it's unfortunate in many ways that some people have pegged the Sustainability Board as a, quote, environmental group or environmental movement, because I think the board members unanimously feel that their job is only partly environmental, but it is as much the social and economic as anything else. So if you look at this report that we submitted to you, the quote on the front page, I think, captures where the board feels its efforts should be placed, which is focusing on education, business and jobs, and rural and agricultural development for Oregon. The board has instituted or undertaken programs around those particular three things. We have a K-12 schools program trying to work broadly with all the school districts as well as the Department of Education on ways that the schools, in the way they operate, can improve their efficiency and lower their costs. Department of Energy and the state has been working very, very closely with schools on the way they design the schools to lower their costs, as well as working on curriculum issues. Secondly, we did a study with the University of Oregon on jobs and businesses to try and figure out what business was doing with respect to sustainability and whether there was anything there that the state could be of assistance to them in improving how they do that if they're doing it on their own. And then lastly, we initiated an agriculture rural communities program trying to figure out ways that the board could directly support or help the ag and rural communities in improving their economies, jobs, and so forth. That program is led by Tracy Liske on the board and Martin Goebel. We've also worked with higher eds and budget issues, Oregon benchmarks, and so forth. But I think that pretty much summarizes the key areas that we've tried to focus on and to bring value to the people of Oregon. So with that, I guess that's my comments.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Chair.
Yes, Representative Hass.
Is there a referral on this bill?
Yes,
Patrick?
There is.
Well, I'd like to ask, do you see a need for, there's no fiscal, as I understand it, on this, and can you...
Well, we were surprised when we heard about that because we are one state agency that has zero state funding. Properly, I think, zeroed our budget out when you had to find some money to keep the state going during the last interim period. So we have been surviving on basically volunteer work from people like from the city of Portland and Portland State and other just people who volunteered, plus a minimal amount of support from DAS and from the governor's office to the board. But we basically... do all of our travel on our own. We put our own time into it, and we've gotten a lot of support, Representative Hass, from a lot of people to keep the board going. So I think the fiscal is pretty darn minimal, if any.
We've got a revised fiscal, and you maybe haven't seen it. You weren't in the room when we talked about that, but we talked about it initially was...
But isn't it? I sort of agree with what Mr.
And I will resend the letter requesting that the referral be rescinded and sent to the floor. We just don't have it back yet.
Okay.
And so we're going to have a work session as soon as we get that straightened out.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Lynn Lundquist. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. Just very brief comments. When we think about the Sustainability Board and the role that they can play, since it is somewhat new, and I think we sometimes think, well, what can they really do? What can they really do? And I think you heard very positive comments from both Mr. Blosser and Mr. Repine about what it's doing not only inside of government but outside of government. At OBA, Oregon Business Association, we believe that there is a competitive advantage in our business climate if we can sustain Oregon's quality of life through environmentally sound business practices, and that's what this is all about. During the last interim, one of the committee members, Ned Dempsey, I think he's vice chair of the committee, and Secretary Bill Bradbury met with us twice, trying to work with the business community and say, what can we do? You know, how could they pick our brains and how we could help in that process? And likewise, we did the same. I only point that out to simply show that they are very serious about this endeavor. And I think we, as a legislative process, need to move this forward and keep it alive. Obviously, with the funding that you've already spoken about has gone away, that doesn't help anything, but in these times we understand that. But from the business, from our standpoint, we felt strong enough about this that we actually put this in sort of a little bill, but we put this in our legislative agenda prior to the session because we felt very strongly in that regard. the fact that you're now expanding it to from eight to ten members, or from seven to nine, I guess, I'm not sure what, two more anyway, from agriculture and forestry, I think that's very very appropriate, even though Mr. Ritzky is already on there from Klamath Falls, because I think what that says is that this is not a threat to the natural resource community. And I think we ought to be just upfront about that, because there are those in the natural resource community that think about sustainability as a threat. It's the, you know, the camel's nose under the tent, that sort of thing, because they think environmental regulation and so forth. I probably have as a strong or a long agricultural background as anybody in the room, and I certainly see the change over time, and I guess I would be hard-pressed to maybe define sustainability in a way that everybody would agree with. And I think that is part of the issue, is because there is that sort of an unknown situation. But the fact remains, if we are going to move forward in this world we find ourselves today, sustainability is very, very important. I think own operation, things that have changed over time, has been remarkable. I didn't call it sustainability. We didn't call it those kind of things. I'll just give you an example. I remember when we, as we rent land, I can remember many farmer saying, you know, well, so-and-so was renting the land, and he just went in and he raped it because he was renting. He didn't own it. Well, obviously sustainability is the reverse of that. I think if we were to try to define sustainability, we might have difficulty, but I think all of us would know it when we saw it. And I think that's very important. So Oregon Business Association is very strongly recommends that the passage of this bill and expanding it. And in the long term, I'd like to encourage us to even give more support to it, if that's possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. John, did you wish to testify too? Sure. Why don't you come on up? John Ledger, who's on the board.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. And I just wanted to mention briefly, this had kind of a remarkable history. The bill that established the board was a joint AOI Defenders of Wildlife bill. And it was one of the most interesting things that I ever, I mean, we kind of got a lot of suspicious looks, you know, and this actually came about when Sarah Vickerman and I, Sarah Vickerman's with Defenders of Wildlife, were having lunch in Lake Oswego. We actually get along quite well when we're not here, you know. And we were having lunch and we were trying to come up with ways that would be non-threatening and non-regulatory. And the idea being, well, if you could deal with things before they become a problem, then you can avoid a lot of the trauma that's triggered by a regulatory action. You know, so a good example would be environmental standards, where if you don't bang into the environmental standard that triggers all these costly things, if you never get there in the first place, everyone's better off. And so that kind of was the genesis for the board. And I wrote up the language for the board. And looking back, and it's probably because I'm a city boy, there was a flaw in it, and that is it didn't have the agricultural and natural resource community built into it properly. And I think just the fact that it has the name, the Sustainability Board, makes people a little nervous. And I think it's very important that community be formally brought into the process, because I think we'll end up with a better product, and I think we'll end up with more confidence in what the board can do. It's been an interesting experience. I'm kind of I wouldn't say a frequent participant on the board, but I'm there sometimes. And it's done some things better than I thought it would, and it's done some things not quite as well. I would have liked to see some things, for instance, like if the governor was concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, something like that, to go through the board, because the board cannot recommend a negative incentive. The board has no regulatory powers, can't hurt anybody by law, cannot recommend a negative incentive. So it's panned out, I think, in the last couple of years much better than it was at first. It's sort of withered on the vine at first, but I think it's become more robust, and I think amending it to add two more people would be a great addition.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 191? Well, committee, we're going to wait until we get the referral before we move this bill, and hopefully that will be next day or so. Thank you. We'll close the hearing. Senate Bill 191. Thank you. Okay, who do we have? Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 389A. Patrick, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Madam Chair. Senate Bill 389A authorizes the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules prohibiting the use of internet or closed circuit media to remotely control a weapon for the purpose of hunting or taking wildlife, game mammals, game birds, or other animals. No fiscal revenue impact on this bill. It was approved by the Senate on a 26-0 vote. There is a company in Texas currently that allows people to subscribe to their service on a private hunting preserve and access a remote-controlled weapon by the internet, and that's what this bill would address. Also in your packets, members, are the -A4 amendments, which, in addition to the language that's existing in the bill, also add a portion authorizing, allowing a person residing in the county to petition their county government to submit to voters in the county the question of applicability of ORS 498-164, which is the language prohibiting the use of bait and dogs in the hunting of bear and cougar. That was from ballot measure 18-1995. We just received -A5 amendments, which would replace the -A4 amendments. They are substantively the same, other than they add a subsection 3, which clarifies that the filing of it and circulating of that petition would follow procedures outlined in the current Oregon statute, Chapter 250.
Would the 5s replace the 4s?
Yes, the -5s then are a replacement of the -4s, and they're simply a clarification that any circulation of a petition would follow statutory rules.
Okay.
The existing one did not have that language.
Okay, I'm going to pass that out to the committee. Thank you. As one of the sponsors on the internet bill, I feel compelled to tell you that I fully support that bill because I thought it was it's just amazing that we've come to this in this country. And so I'm just dumbfounded by that's even possible. So, Jared, do you want to come up and explain it better? Maybe what we're trying to do and what we did.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jared Broadfoot, representing the Oregon chapters of Safari Club International, First for Hunters. Here in support of Senate Bill 389 and the -5 amendments now. Quickly, through the internet hunting bill, it was in December of last year, I believe. I attended a meeting in Texas with the leaders of most all of the national wildlife conservation organizations, hunting organizations, and gun organizations. At that point, the issue of internet hunting came up because we were in Texas, and a gentleman had started a website, and I'll walk through the website with you. You can log on from your computers, in your offices, at your homes, wherever you're at, dial this website up, and it gives you the opportunity to pay, shoot target practice, and or shoot live animals. They have a feeder set up, or it's on a private ranch. There's an actual gun connected to a computer that's connected to a video camera that gives you a live feed of what you're looking at. It's got a crosshair on the screen. A deer walks up. You actually put the crosshair on the animal. When you push the mouse button, the rifle will go off and expend a live projectile at that animal. As in any, we don't call this hunting, but as in any hunting scenario, when a gun goes off, if wherever you're aiming is where that bullet's going to go, and if the aim is wrong, the animal could be wounded. If the aim is true, the animal could be killed. The operation would then cut the animal up and box it up and ship it to you. By no standard, from Safari Club's standpoint, does this meet our standard for ethical and fair chase of game. Plain and simple, it's not hunting. We've been very adamant about that since day one, since the moment we heard about this, and with the conservation groups that we met with at that time, Safari Club pledged to take the lead and make sure that this sort of practice was banned in every state in the union and also on the national level, and we have kept that promise to our conservation partners to ensure that internet hunting be banned, because it's not hunting. It's a sick, twisted idea on the internet. Now, the gentleman who started the website said it was for disabled hunters, and that would be a good avenue for them. We have worked very closely with disabled hunters, and there are avenues to get those folks out into the field with the proper equipment to make sure that they have an enjoyable hunting experience. It's not hunting when you're sitting in your living room and just killing things over the internet. So with that, obviously we're very passionate about that bill. The Dash 5 amendments, which replace the Dash 4s, this is a very controversial issue. This has been a controversial issue in this state since 1994, when the anti-hunting community placed on the ballot and successfully passed a ban on the use of dogs for the management of bears and cougars and the ban on bait for the management of bears. At that time, we advocated, and everyone in the management community, wildlife management community, advocated that that was a bad deal. There would be numerous unintended consequences of that measure. Let me please note, because it's important when looking at that election in 1994, that the Oregon State Police subsequently raided and executed a search warrant on a known poacher's place of residence, found numerous illegal wildlife parts, illegal violations of the wildlife code, also found a signed contract between some of the proponents of ballot measure 18 and the poacher, where he was paid $9,000 for his services to obtain footage of bear and or cougar hunts. It would be our guess, since he was a poacher, they would be illegal bear and or cougar hunts. Whether that footage was actually used in the campaign, we can't tell. We never saw the footage that he handed over. But to frame this debate, it's important to understand that. And we've got that on file. It's a state police record. It's public information. The election was very, very close. It was based on rhetoric and emotion. The premise that using these management tools was cruel and or inhumane. The majority, if you look at the counties, rural Oregon opposed this measure by a margin of about 60 to 40. There were, I believe, around 6 or 9 counties that were the only counties who a majority of the voters in those counties supported this measure. And as you can guess, 3 of those just happened to be Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties. And in doing a little bit of research, I know some of the 5 southwestern counties all voted against it by a margin of 61 no, 39 yes. So rural Oregon defeated this initiative, but because of the initiative process, rural Oregon was strapped with this ban. Since then, we've had a large problem. Bear and cougar populations have increased. Cougar population has almost doubled. We've had significant loss of livestock. We've had significant public safety concerns. And the only thing that we've been able to do in the over 10 years since ballot measure 18 passed to address any of this is a reactive measure. Yes, we suppose you can kill a bear or cougar if it's attacking you, your kid, or your animals. It's reactive. We've done nothing proactively. And if we don't do something, which we've testified before this committee before, it's going to be too late. Some folks would have you believe that we need to wait until someone gets attacked or killed before we do anything because there's not a problem. Well, we're not going to sit around and wait for someone to get attacked to do something about this problem. Department of Fish and Wildlife has testified that, actually in the committee hearing we had in Baker City, that one of the number one causes to elk populations of predation is cougars. We know this. Our folks that we represent who are in the woods a lot, who own logging businesses or whatever, are telling us. Our elk and deer populations are being absolutely wiped out by bear and cougar predation. So it's not only public safety, which is our number one concern, and livestock depredation and damage, but it's also the decimation of elk and deer populations as well. We need to manage those populations correctly. What the Dash 5 amendments do, and this is in response to the arguments over the past 10 years, the proponents of Measure 18 and the opponents of hunting have said the people have spoken. We need to listen to the will of the people. And I've obviously become sensitive to that. This amendment says that a county can hold a countywide election. It's an election. It's not a county commission decision. It's not a city decision or anything like that. They can hold an election and determine if they want to allow the use of dogs and or bait for bear and cougar management in their county. So there's nothing about this. It's going to be an executive decision. It'll be a very public and open election process, as was done in 1994. But the fact of the matter is, Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County aren't going to be able to, in this scenario, tell Wallowa, Union, or Grant counties, how they're supposed to deal with predators they have to live with every day. This is a local issue for those folks. Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas County don't have to deal with that many bears and or cougars. They have to deal with some, but certainly not as many as the folks in rural Oregon. This is a rural versus urban issue because, obviously, the folks like myself who live in Wilsonville, I don't have to deal with bears and cougars in my backyard. But when I'm on the phone with the members that we represent and family members, this is obviously a big problem. They're afraid to let their kids go outside and play. You've heard a lot of this testimony before. So I want to be very clear that this does not in any way amend ORS 498-164, which was the ban that was passed in 1994. We're not repealing anything. We're not changing that law. What we're doing is saying if a county wants to, there's no shall, there's no requirement. If a county wants to, someone in that county wants to petition their governing body and go through the correct statutorily provided process, they can have this question brought before all of the voters in that county. And those voters can have it, can make up their mind of what they want to do, whatever species it is and whatever management tool they want to authorize. I don't think it's it would be fair for us to dictate to them which decisions they would have. If we're going to give them a decision to make, let's let them make up their mind, because they have before, and in those counties, they've said no, and they want these tools, and they've been very vocal about that. One of the other requirements is that if an ordinance like this would be passed, that they have to forward a letter to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, to the commission, and let them know they've done this. It's my understanding, and when we drafted this, when we worked very hard on it, and the questions we asked with the Department, with Legislative Council, and then subsequently the Department of Fish and Wildlife was, let's say Wallowa County passed this. What would be the scenario? And we drafted this so the scenario would be that the Department of Fish and Wildlife still retains all the management ability. The county has no authority to manage these populations, but the county says, okay, we want to allow the use of dogs for the management of cougar populations. Fish and Wildlife Commission has the authority to come in and say, well, okay, that's fine. We're only going to issue 10 tags, 25 tags, however many special permits or tags that can then be used with the use of dogs and or whatever tool that county decides they want to allow. So this is, like I said, letting those folks have their say. Just like it's not fair that Grant County or Deschutes County dictate to Multnomah County their tax structure or if they want a tax increase or not, it's not fair that the folks in the counties that don't have the high populations of these predators and have to deal with the economic suffering that these predators cause because of lost elk and deer tags and the public safety threat, that they shouldn't be able to tell the rural Oregon parts of the state how they have to live with these predators. So obviously, this is a very controversial issue. This, in our opinion, is absolutely the best way to deal with this because it's letting the voters decide. You guys aren't making the decision for them. You're giving them the opportunity to have their say. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has regarding the bill or the amendments.
I'm sure you're going to get a few.
I would appreciate it.
Representative Hass?
I have a couple questions.
Sure.
My first is, which is more important to you, the original bill or this amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Hass, they are both equally important to us. Internet hunting is disgusting, and the bear and cougar problem has terrorized rural residents of the state for long enough. So they're both very, very important to us.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes.
I don't think there's anybody in this room who'd quarrel with the internet hunting bill. And I'm not saying that your amendment is all that unreasonable either. I'm just saying that by putting it on that bill, you're putting that whole bill into jeopardy. And my fear is you're tanking the bill so that it won't go anywhere because you're putting this landmine in there that, as you acknowledged, is extremely controversial. And I would hate to see that kill this other internet bill. That's a very big issue. Controversial, yes. And should it pass? I don't know. But that should be able to live or die on its own merits and not foul up this other bill that I would guess has unanimous support in the Capitol. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Hass, we don't anticipate that it's going to torpedo or tank the bill. I think this issue has a lot of support. The issue itself, yes, is controversial. This amendment we don't view as being controversial at all because we're not repealing, amending, or changing the statute. What we're doing is letting the folks at the local level make the decisions with a vote. So we're supporting the voting public at their local level, and we see this amendment as a very common sense approach to fixing this problem, and we see we can fix two problems at once. So,
thank you. I might add too, we had 50 co-sponsors on that Cougar bill, so there is a lot of support, even though that's a very tough issue.
Madam Chair, let's that's a big enough issue that it should stand alone. I honestly believe that, and I know your client would like to have that bill and would like to do this other bill. It would be good for business for your client, but I would hate to see. I'm just saying that it threatens and probably jeopardizes the internet bill that there's no objection to in the entire Capitol. So,
thank you, Representative Burley.
Thank you. With respect to the bill, the original bill, I'm kind of curious, how exactly would this apply? I mean, this person that has this set up right now resides in Texas. The World Wide Web, as you know, it's everywhere. So how would this apply? I mean, how would we here in Oregon prohibit it? Does it mean that we would prohibit anybody from establishing such a thing in Oregon, or are we going to prohibit anybody that signs on to the web from being able to access this site in Texas?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it's an excellent question, which we've talked a lot about. There is, in our opinion, in the discussions we've had with legislative counsel and other folks, there's no way we can regulate what goes on in Texas. This bill is aimed at prohibiting these types of operations in Oregon from getting set up or operating. And I know the Texas legislature and Representative Ray Allen from the Dallas-Fort Worth area is working very hard to ensure that this gets banned in Texas as well. So the effort is to ban the practice of these facilities or operations in each one of the states, because it's really difficult to regulate across. I mean, it's impossible to regulate across the border on this type of issue. So we feel if we can get it in each state and prohibit the operations in our home state, that we can stop that, and also with federal legislation as well. So,
thank you.
A couple of follow-ups, if I may. So I just want to make sure we're all absolutely clear on this. The way this thing's worded is that it would prohibit the use of this technology to remotely control a weapon. Now, if this were to pass and be signed into law, if I were to sign on to the web and access this Texas site, which this bill would not shut down, would I then be in violation of this law?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it's my opinion that you would not, because the actual firearm is in the state of Texas, even though you were operating it from Oregon. But that would be a question, I'm assuming, for the Attorney General's office to look into, or even maybe State Police or Department of Fish and Wildlife. But it was our intent, obviously, to regulate this as much as we can, the authority that we have. But I don't believe that you would be able to regulate someone from just logging onto the internet here and using a site there. I know it's a bad example, and I apologize. I know they have the same problem with, let's say, internet gambling, as far as what's legal in what state, where the server's hosted, that kind of stuff. So I know it's a fine line, but we're confident with being able to ban it, and, you know, if we're able to ban it in each of the 50 states, we can really squash this before it becomes an even bigger problem.
And I don't, and you know, Madam Chair, please don't misunderstand me. I mean, I absolutely support this as well, but I just want to make sure that, A, we're all clear on what it is we're voting on, for one thing, and secondly, if maybe there's something we need to do to tighten it up a little bit. That's why I'm asking the question. So I think that, again, the intent here is to make sure that we ban or prohibit anybody from setting up such an operation within the state of Oregon. But I don't think, and I'm certainly not the attorney here, but I don't think this would prohibit anybody from signing on and accessing the Texas site, for example, which is still in operation. and I don't know if the intent was to block that. I don't know if you can block those types of things, as you pointed out. The other question I had was on page 3, paragraph 19, the last sentence says, the rules may exempt, this refers to the rules that the Department of Agriculture would promulgate, may exempt the State Department of Fish and Wildlife or any public body or agents of the department or public body from the prohibition. Why do we want to exempt ODF&W from such a prohibition?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, another great question. Let me give you an example. For instance, when the department in some of their activities live traps turkeys, for instance, they have guns, net guns, that are remotely controlled, and once those turkeys are then within the vicinity of where they want to capture them, those net guns are discharged remotely, net the turkeys, and then they are able to relocate them or transplant them or whatever they do with them. So there are specific examples like that. The other reason that we built that in there is we never imagined in a million years that we would be looking at internet hunting, and who knows what else can come down the pipe, or who knows what management technologies will come at us for management of species. So we want to make sure that the Department of Fish and Wildlife has some flexibility to deal on this issue, because there may be something someday that's considered a weapon that needs to be controlled remotely that they use for management purposes, such as the net guns that we already use. So we want to make sure that if we did have something that came up, we could address it through the commission, which is another public process, and wouldn't have to wait a couple years to come back through a legislative session to deal with something like we're having to do now, because right now they don't have the authority to regulate this.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We'll call Ron Anglin now. Do you think we need a legislative council opinion?
I'll go talk to him.
Good morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The department has already testified in support of this bill, the internet hunting ban. As you've already heard, it is something that has become a viable operation that when in hunting regulations were first considered way back when, something like this was never considered a remote possibility. And now we're faced with the real reality of having to deal with it. I guess I'd like to continue to express our support for the bill as originally written on controlling internet hunting, answer a couple of questions that were raised by Representative Burley. That you're correct, a person could log on to the internet and could hunt in another state, unless that state had adopted a ban to prohibit internet hunting within their own state. The regulations that our commission could adopt would only ban the use of internet hunting within Oregon and give us the means then to take legal action against somebody that set up an operation in Oregon to offer that. So if somebody in Texas, say, was trying to utilize that in Oregon, that would be an illegal activity. It would be, you know, we'd have to talk to the enforcement folks on how you would get at addressing the person in Texas and whether they had a hunting license and all that. So you can see that it really gets quite complicated in reviewing it as far as all the other states go. But it would clearly give our commission, who has the authority to regulate manner and method of take, it would clearly give them the authority to ban this activity within Oregon, and the commission would be willing to do that. The second question was, again, why the exemption for the department and for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Sometimes there are unintended consequences that when it says no person shall, that also applies to us. And we have found in a couple of different instances that what we thought we had authority to do under our general statutory authority, that in a strict legal interpretation several years down the road based on new court cases, et cetera, that we found that we did not have the authority to do something that we had been doing. And there could be technology advances that would allow us to sit back and take individual animals, if you will, that were causing damage from a remote controlled means and be able to target something that was in the act. And again, it's out there a ways, and we may not really know what that is at this point in time, but if it is no person shall, then it definitely restricts us in the future if of taking advantage of something that would, from a sound or have good sound scientific management capability. And this wording would give us that flexibility. As far as the dash fives, just saw the dash fives a second ago, had already seen the dash fours a little bit earlier. The department has no written testimony prepared on that, and we'll obviously institute anything the legislature adopts.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Roble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The dash fives, as you read them, does that put any conditions on your management of either of these populations in those counties if they chose to do to implement this?
No. Chair Smith, Representative Roblin, in looking at the dash fours, the commission still has full authority to set seasons and manner of take. It appears to us that the amendment would do is reestablish within those specific counties the method of take of using dogs and bait, and then still leave it to the commission to decide the scope of that.
Any further questions, Ms. Drain? Representative Sumner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, did I understand you to say that the department has made no decision on the dash five? You have no position whatsoever?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Burley?
How much of ODF&W's budget is funded by hunting license fees?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, the overall Wildlife Division budget consists of a small portion of general fund, license dollars, and federal dollars, and just under 50% of our overall Wildlife Division budget is made up of license dollars, which are hunting license tags and fees.
What would you say is the general trend? I won't hold you to any exact numbers, but what's the general trend right now with the populations of mule deer and elk, particularly in eastern Oregon?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, species have been declining. Specifically, mule deer have been declining for a lot of years, not only in Oregon, but also across the West. It's all happened at about the same time for a variety of reasons. Elk populations have recently started declining, probably from a couple of different reasons. Some were specific actions on our part to shoot populations down to management objectives, which we have achieved. The thing that has surprised us, though, is that we're seeing lower calf survival than what we've expected, and those populations have not shown the elasticity to be able to rebound as quickly as what we had expected. So some of our research in Northeast Oregon, as we've already testified in front of this committee, is showing that cougars are having an impact on calf survival.
Have you had to reduce the number of tags available in units?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, yes, we have, again, for a variety of reasons, but we have reduced tag opportunity and hunting opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Sally Mackler and Kelly Peterson, do you guys want to come up together? We have one other person after you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good Good morning, Chair Smith and committee members. My name is Sally Mackler. I'm a volunteer. I'm representing the Sierra Club as a wildlife coordinator for the group and speaking on behalf of our 23,000-plus members in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I was a little bit disconcerted about the late notice on the amendment to the bill. I am a member of the public, and it was hard for me to find out that this was happening. So I imagine there would probably have been more people here had they been aware of the issue, because it is a controversial issue, and it has received a public vote twice. So I think more people would have been present had they known about it. And I'm sorry that I didn't have that foreknowledge. I'd like to make some comments about the amendment to the bill, and that it seems conflicting in that one portion of the bill, the 389 portion of the bill that would prohibit what is considered to be an unethical hunting practice, remote control hunting, is then being amended by trying to remove protections for wildlife that the voters voted in and felt were unethical, practices that were unethical. The public felt bear baiting and hound hunting were considered unethical by the public. And I don't think there's that much difference of a standard. I think many people, including many hunters, don't consider it hunting to attract an animal to one specific spot with a bag of food or garbage and then shoot the animal from behind a blind while they're eating. I don't find that to be any more or less unethical than remote control hunting. It is also dangerous for animal populations to have them come and be attracted and all come together in one spot. It encourages disease transmission amongst the animals if you have them coming in an unnatural way and forming together in groups like that. So I think there are concerns for me anyway, and that it seems to be somewhat of a conflict here between the amendment and the original bill. The Sierra Club did feel that the intent of the 389 was good, and you know, showed some limited support for that, but we can't support the bill as it is with these amendments. As far as the management implications go, I think there's a lot of things that are yet unknown. On the ground, for instance, we have hunt zones that may contain more than one county, may contain a portion of a county. For instance, if a quota is full in a certain hunt zone, how can you tell a person in County A that they can only hunt in half of the county because the quota is closed on the other half of a dividing line? I think it creates a management problem on the ground. I think we have less OSP wardens on the ground now, and I see that this presents a problem. And I've just brought up the quota issue as one example. I think if you look more closely at it, there are probably other concerns and issues as well. You may not know that the state is divided into hunt zones, and that's how these animals are being managed now. It's through a quota system on each hunt zone, which means each hunt zone has a kill quota over which the you're not allowed to exceed, and the department closes down the hunt zone at that point. So I think it would be confusing and conflicting to have a county system that is not in mesh with the statewide system. So I think that creates some serious problems. Mr. Englund indicated that the counties would not be having control over management, that they would be simply voting this in, and that all management would be up to the state level. I think this whole idea sort of sets a poor precedent. Wildlife law is usually done on a statewide basis. because it's a large overview of a population of animals. They don't abide by county lines or anything like that. So they are managed as a whole population throughout the state. So I think that's something to keep under consideration. And to try and go back to my idea of setting a poor precedent, I have a concern about that, in that what would prohibit other counties, if bills like this were passed, from deciding themselves on other controversial issues like Measure 37 or gay marriage or speed limits, drinking age, et cetera, so I think it's a dangerous area to go into for a number of reasons. Fiscal impacts haven't been discussed on this. I believe there are probably some embedded issues here that we're not aware of fiscally as well, and I don't know exactly what they might be, but I can imagine there would be some cost to the state to try and grapple with this problem and try and deal with each county on an individual basis, setting perhaps different tag limits or seasons or bag limits or whatever in each individual county. So I can imagine that there would be some impact statewide. As far as the counties go, they're probably more strapped for funding than the state is, so I can't imagine that they would be able to absorb any of these additional costs as well. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than just a simple vote of the people. And I come from a rural county. I live in Jackson County, and our county, among many other counties, was in favor of banning or defeating Measure 34, which was a repeal effort to repeal Measure 18, which came 2 years afterwards in 1996. So I think there was a pretty good mandate there from rural counties as well as urban counties that they did not want to see Measure 18 repealed. In conclusion, I think... Oh, I wanted to say one other thing. You had some concerns about the wording in the internet hunting portion of the bill in terms of exemptions, and I think that could all be obliterated if the wording were changed to just say this would prohibit sport hunting by remote control, but would allow management efforts such as trapping turkeys or whatever else might come up. I don't think that we're going to see the ODF&W authorities doing remote control hunting for sport in their offices or anything like that. So I think that would solve the problem of that confusion there. In conclusion, in weighing the costs and benefits of the bill here that's in front of you with the amendment attached, the Sierra Club is going to have to oppose the bill. We had supported the intent, as I said before, of the banning the internet hunting, and we would like to support that, but we can't because of the amendment on the bill. And also, we really don't feel that we're losing that much by not supporting the bill. The beginning part of the bill, the internet hunting aspect of the bill, because we don't have any of these ranches here that are allowing this at this point in time. We do not allow game ranches for shooting of game animals here. We don't allow canned hunts in this state. And I think the biggest issue for us is that the Fish and Wildlife Commission has the ability to make these rules right now. They don't need a legislative mandate through a bill to tell them that they may do so, which is the wording in the bill. So the Fish and Wildlife Commission has that ability right now, and I think that's where the real issue will be decided, will be in the rulemaking aspect, and I think that we would be seeing that happen in any event. So losing that portion of the bill, we don't think is that big of a loss when you consider the cost-benefit ratio at this point in time. So I appreciate.
Thank you. Appreciate your listening. Any questions from Ms. Mather? Do you have any?
Just real quickly, was this part of your written testimony?
I just provided that as background.
And may I ask why, in particular, you highlighted 498.012?
Is that the damage statute? I'm sorry,
yeah.
I don't have that right in front of me. I believe that's probably the damage statute.
I think it's a damage statute.
Yes.
Yeah. I included those just because I wanted you to be aware of the fact that Oregon law is working very well. it has an aspect in here that allows the use of hounds for livestock loss. It has the ability for property owners, if they are experiencing damage, to use hounds. Measure 18 was a very narrowly crafted bill which only prohibited the use of hounds for sport, and that impacted a few hundred individuals who had hound packs. So you are allowed to use hounds if you are having a damage concern for crops or for livestock loss or personal property. You'll also have the ability of public agents to use hounds for public safety concerns. Those aspects were untouched by Measure 18, which is, just as I mentioned before, extremely very narrowly crafted for sport trophy hunters who wanted to use packs of dogs to hunt, which many people found as unethical as remote control hunting would be to other individuals. So it was only affected a very narrow number of people. The mortality rates for cougar kills have increased dramatically in the state since before we had the passage of Measure 18 versus now. They've practically doubled. So people can still hunt cougars without dogs, and they are doing so at rates that have far exceeded those prior to the passage of Measure 18. So I included the statutes just so that you can see we do have safety statutes that allow someone to kill a cougar if they feel even threatened by it. They do allow the use of dogs for public safety and for the protection of public property and livestock and such. That's why I included that, so that you can see that Oregon law is already, we believe, very well covering the issue of public safety and damage control.
Follow up,
thank you. So if I understand what you're saying, 498.012, which is the damage provisions in the law, you're saying that under that, a landowner or producer or whatever the case may be can use hounds on cougar on their own property if it's to control damage.
Yes, and also on adjacent properties with permission of property owner, which has always been the case.
Is that explicitly stated in here? Because I'm reading it, I don't see anything in here about the use of hounds.
Yeah, it's definitely in there.
I have a copy of it.
Okay. I'm sure it's here somewhere. Yeah, here we go.
Oh. Here's something.
Other side.
Well, 2A says cougar. Oh, yeah, he's saying hounds.
Okay.
Yeah.
498.012, nothing in wildlife law is intended to prevent any person from taking wildlife that is causing damage as public nuisance poses online for 20.
Right.
Yeah, I wasn't looking at the other section.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks. Seeing none, thank you. Kelly Peterson. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm here on behalf of our 100,000 members and constituents. And I actually submitted written testimony to all of you yesterday about Senate Bill 389. We felt the bill had, we liked the bill. We did have a concern about exempting the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for any reason or for anybody. About an hour later, I did find out about the Dash 4 or 5 amendment, which is really why I'm here. And we do think the Internet hunting bill is good reform, but not at the price of overturning what the voters have spoken on twice. And if the amendment is adopted, we would also oppose the bill. And I started down here in 1997 just as a volunteer, and I would come down, I would take time off and come and testify in opposition to any bill that would repeal ballot measure 18. So I've done this for a while. It never gets easier, ever. But there's probably been about 25 bills that have been introduced to repeal or weaken ballot measure 18, and the Dash 4, I guess, and Dash 5 amendment, in our mind, just really puts a controversial bill. It kind of rides on the coattail of a bill that really had good intentions. And we also think the bill, such as this, should stand alone, and that the public should really have more of an opportunity to testify on this. And I was grateful to find out a little bit about 3 o'clock yesterday. And I don't probably need to go into a lot of the statutes that Sally Meckler explained, except for in 2001, there was another bill that went further, just clarifying that you can kill any bear or cougar that you perceive to be a threat simply by seeing it in the daylight, and you can do that without a permit. And I did attach just some editorials that have come in from this last session from opinion makers from newspapers, and I also attached some from the 2003 session, and not much has really changed in that. And, you know, we do think -4 or -5 amendments would create kind of a patchwork of laws and would set a bad precedent. And we do think the voters have spoken. So with that, I do appreciate you letting me testify. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Robles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would each of you just comment briefly if you know what your organizations are doing in Texas in regards to the initial problem?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, you mean on internet hunting? To be honest, I don't know, actually. I mean, I know that we've supported the internet hunting bills around the country, but I'm so focused on Oregon, just as my native state. I don't know.
Any further questions? Representative Burley?
Thank you. I appreciate you providing us these numbers and the cougar hunting quotas and harvest levels, and you're right, they have increased. In fact, I think it was 2003's figures, although it looks like 2004 surpassed that, they was one of the highest ever in recorded history of cougar harvests.
Yes, sir.
And I think what that's indicative of is the rapid increase in the cougar population numbers. And what concerns me right now, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is between the cougars and the bears and what may soon become our next friendly species, the wolf, we are seeing huge declines in some of our populations, as you point out, in some of these certain hunting units. Particularly in northeastern Oregon, they've had to reduce the number of elk tags significantly, which is not only an issue for hunter access and opportunities, but it's also an issue for State Department wildlife funds, as was pointed out in earlier testimony. I spent a lot of time this week on the phone with a constituent of mine that owns and operates significant amounts of land in eastern Oregon, private land that they have hunting opportunities on. He spent time with the commission in Prineville the other week when they were over there, and he's very concerned about the management objectives for deer and elk and the numbers and the declining populations. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation reported recently, and unfortunately the article's in my bill file dealing with the wolf bill, not this one, but they reported recently that the population of elk that typically comes out of Yellowstone National Park up into the Gardner area of Montana historically has been around 19,000 to 20,000 head of elk, and it's down now to 5. And they attribute that to cougars, bears, and wolves. So my concern is, how do we get our hands around this problem? How do you help us get our hands around this problem so we don't see a decimation of these big game herds?
Representative Burley, Chair Smith, I think it's a complicated issue, and I think that science has not shown that predators are responsible primarily for that decline. I think if you look into the biological research that's been done on the issue of predator versus prey populations and how they interact with one another, the overriding belief is that the factor that most significantly impacts the ungulate or prey populations has to do more with availability and quality of forage and habitat as opposed to hunting. I mean, predator hunting, predators taking prey, and in terms of them actually decreasing or jeopardizing their population numbers. So that would be my first response, would be that it's unfortunate that these populations are experiencing this, and I don't think that there is any real substantive evidence that points to the fact that predators are a primary reason for that happening. In some situations where the populations are already stressed and are already at a disadvantage because of perhaps the forage situation, the habitat situation, and their numbers are already down and they're in a fragile condition, then I believe that it is much more dangerous in terms of prey having a significant impact, I mean predator having a significant impact on the prey population. So first, I think the jury's out in terms of actually pointing the dirty finger at the predator and saying you are the primary factor responsible. I think it is perhaps one of the most most easily controlled or managed issues by us would be to look at that aspect of the problem as opposed to habitat and forage, which is something that I think you as a body are probably not going to be really effective in trying to manage. So I think that's part of the problem, is that it is perceived that it is a predator issue when indeed the primary factor is not that. I think the other thing that we need to look at is you had mentioned that about the fact that there were so... I guess what I'm trying to say is I think the reason why we're seeing some of these issues is because tag numbers of cougars have increased dramatically in terms of the hunting numbers. You were talking about how the numbers had changed so and it was an issue. And I think that the reason is that tag numbers for cougars increased dramatically as part of the strategy that management put into place when Measure 18 took place. We increased the number of tag numbers dramatically for cougars. And I think that that is part of your question. And in addition to that, the monies raised by the department because of that increase is substantial, quite substantial, and I think it probably offsets whatever decrease they've seen in tag numbers for elk. In reading over the big game management reports, it looks like elk is at or above management objectives in most of the state. And yes, there certainly are certainly areas, as you pointed out, in the northeastern corner of our state where elk populations are decreasing because, as Mr. Anglin pointed out, the recruitment factor is an issue. We're not having calves being born as readily as would like to be seen. And
a follow-up, yes, thank you.
Yes, and those populations have been in decline over many, many years, decades, over 40 years. This is not a new issue in northeastern Oregon.
Well, I think when Mr. Anglin mentioned lower calf survival, he wasn't very explicit on whether it was just a birth issue or a survival issue, but from what I hear from folks that I consider to be experts in this field, a lot of the calves are preyed upon by the bears up to 2 weeks old, and that's mm-hmm. part of the reason we're having problems with the elk populations in the northeast. But, Sally, I'd like to go back to a comment you said earlier on mm-hmm. debating whether or not this is a predator issue or a habitat issue for big mm-hmm. game. Mm-hmm. And so, based on what you said, am I correct in understanding then that the Sierra Club would support more active management to create better habitat and forage?
I would think so.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, we always want to create better habitat. Certainly. Also, I think it's interesting to note that some of the counties that are in that have concerns about this, Grant County, Umatilla County, Wallowa County, happen to be located in the hunt zone where they have reached the quota for cougar kills. So allowing hound hunting in those areas wouldn't affect the number of cougars that are killed in that particular hunt zone because they're already reaching quota through the use of people carrying elk tags and shooting elk and deer tags and shooting cougar, mm-hmm. incidentally.
Thank you. You have a question? Representative Rover?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is more about the people who enjoy the outdoors just to go and visit. Hikers and others like myself and mm-hmm. Son-in-law, and you know the issue in California with cougar and the ones that have really been highlighted have been people who were out running, jogging, and other things who were attacked by cougar. And I am very concerned that that's going to start happening in our areas. And so that brings me to the point that we do have laws that allow us to take an animal if it's hunting us. But that also implies that as I'm out running or hiking, I should be having a weapon. that concerns me for safety with other people. So because I have those people who have weapons been trained, are they going to do the right kinds of things? So I worry a lot about safety. And I guess I'd just like to hear your ideas about how to, you know, the protecting ourselves means that we need to arm people who are going to go out where all these animals are. Or, you know, there have been some indications that using hounds keeps, even if you don't take them, keeps some of the animals from invading that interface that we have that continues to grow. And the same is true now with a number of my friends with bears in Coos County. They always take their rifle when they go to their barn now because they've come upon bears more than a couple times in their barns. And so even though they try to lock up and do stuff, all of a sudden we're having more and more opportunity for that interface to result in a negative outcome. So I just wanted to have your input on that.
I think as long as we still have rural wilderness areas in our state, we are going to have large predators. And that threat is always there. You can't have it both ways. We pride ourselves on our habitat and having a lot of open space in wilderness areas. So we will continue to have predators there, and there will always be conflicts. There's no way to avoid that unless you want to eradicate the species or take out maybe 80% of the species. There's no way to ensure that there will not be conflicts. So I think you have to be moderate and conservative about how you deal with that. I agree that there's a problem with having people taking weapons with them when they're out hunting. They'll probably end up shooting themselves or shooting themselves in the foot. And this is not a good idea. But I think that current law really does allow us to take care of most of these situations. And I don't believe that allowing hound hunting, which would maybe increase the kill numbers by a tiny bit, an insignificant bit, would really rectify or solve that problem. In 5 years, we have increased the number of cougars killed in the state by 60% in terms of hunting mortalities. You're not going to see anything near that if you open specific counties up to hounding. You're not going to see numbers that even anywhere near approach that. So the philosophy that says if we kill more cougars, we're going to be safe, really hasn't proven itself, because we've done a great job at increasing the mortality rates for cougars in the last 5 to 10 years. And the perception is that we are not seeing an improved safety aspect to this. And hanging your hopes on allowing an unethical practice that people said no to come back is not going to solve your problem, because the increment of animals that will be taken out by that practice are going to be very, very small compared to what's already happened in the last 5 to 10 years. So I don't think that's the answer to the problem either.
Follow up?
Yeah. I don't know if there is an answer. Yeah. There's no way to keep you safe, to keep everybody safe.
The follow-up that I have on that one is that I recognize that the take has increased, but it has not increased with the growth of population. If we read things, so there continues to be a greater number of cougars than the amount that the Fish and Wildlife was said they were going to manage for. So if the state has said we're going to manage for 3,500 cougars, I think that's a reasonable number of cougars to have in the state. And even though we've increased the pace, we now have 5,500 cougars. We haven't seemed to get to that. To find a way to get to that point where we're keeping the 3,500 or 4,000 cougars that we have set as a limit. So how do we get to that point? Even though we're taking them, if you look at them, we're not taking them at the rate that they're reproducing. So,
thank you. I appreciate your comment, and I think that we don't really know how many cougars there are in the state.
That's true.
And you can ask Mr. Anglin, and I think he would support that. Nobody knows. We all have a perception that there's a cougar behind every tree, and that may or may not be true, but I feel a lot of that has to do with media attention on the issue. And in terms of, may I just use an example, the Bend situation that was brought to your attention or has been brought to the forefront. I think if people were more aware of what the law allowed and they utilized the law to its fullest extent, that rogue cougar would have been removed and taken out. right from the get-go, and we wouldn't have a situation where, oh my gosh, we're all being terrorized, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. We wouldn't be seeing this repeatedly coming up in the media and being brought to one's attention, which I think leaves people with an impression, which may or may not be true, but it's not backed by fact in terms of actual censuses of cougar populations. The cougar population is based on a model. The department uses a model with an increased increment. Every single year, it increases by a certain percent. So if we keep on going, pretty soon, there are going to be 5 million cougars in the state if we keep adding an increment like that. So on the ground, I don't think anybody really knows how many cougars that there really are.
And just a quick thought. Sure. I agree with that. I think modeling is a hard way of doing that.
Yeah.
There was a bill introduced earlier that had to do with keeping track and trying to find out the numbers, and that it doesn't seem to have been going anywhere. But the issue that I have with that one is that it's the only thing we have is modeling,
mm-hmm.
And it could be the other way. It could be that there's a whole lot more cougars out there, and what we're seeing is just the beginning of those cougars. So, I mean, that model has the same problem on both sides.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
That very well could be. As a rule, large predators like cougars are self-limiting. They do not overrun the landscape like a deer or elk do, and they just don't. They are limited by their prey populations. They just don't.
I had a question before. Ms. Mackler, what has the Sierra Club done to educate people, if you say the media is doing...
To educate people what?
Yeah, about the cougar population.
I don't understand your question.
You said the media...
I'm sorry.
Take the Ben situation, the media is playing, they're not telling you the facts. And what has the Sierra Club done to get the facts out there?
Well, if... media would call us, we would tell them, but I mean, we usually find out after the fact that something's happening. It comes out in the paper and nobody calls.
We haven't done anything.
Well, I wouldn't say that we haven't done anything. I mean, I would say that we do try to let people know through our own networks, through newsletters and things like that, and our website and those kinds of things.
Okay.
Yes, we do, but we would like to have a chance also to speak out when these things occur, and most of the time we're not given that opportunity.
Thank you. Representative
one-sided.
Yeah, thank you. Sally, you were talking about wilderness areas and these large undeveloped areas that these animals reside in, but, unfortunately, because of the growth in numbers, and as I'm sure you're well aware, these animals have their territories or range or whatever you want to call it. And, mm-hmm. The one right now that they're tracking around Bend and the vicinity, they believe, not rogue, but what the experts say is a juvenile cat that's looking to establish its property. And, I'm sitting here thinking, what am I going to tell the school teacher who has a 5-year-old kid that they found out that cat was sleeping under her back deck?
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to tell people when last year ODF&W trapped one out of a tree right along a very popular hiking trail going up Pilot Butte, which is right smack in the middle of Bend, a stone's throw away from a middle school. Also this year they saw tracks of two right near a grade school going right by the Morningstar Family Relief Nursery. I mean, the question is, we've got to get these numbers down. I'm not sure exactly what ODF&W's MO is for these animals, but using dogs is a much more effective way of harvesting these animals, and I think we need to get the population down and under control before we do start getting people killed.
All I can say to that is that the management objectives has been set, the kill quotas have been set for sport purposes. Yeah, that can be changed. So you could have increased hunting in those areas or increased mortality rates in those areas. And that if there is a problem, it should be dealt with immediately because the law allows that. If sightings have happened, use dogs. You have the ability to use dogs. Go out there and remove the offending animal. You have that ability. Allowing people to sport hunt with dogs is going to be less effective than actually targeting the problem animal and going after it in a timely fashion when you have a fresh scent and you can get after it. I think that's more of an answer, is a response mechanism so that we can utilize the laws that we have. The laws allow this. Something needs to be done to see that they are taken advantage of and that these animals are taken out if they're presenting a problem. And there's nothing that prohibits that from happening. I think that is really the crux of the problem, is that, yes, there are legitimate concerns, and I don't deny that. There are problems, and there are going to be problems, as I said before, as long as we have cougars in the state and we are in areas of human population that are close to their territories, we're going to have problems, and that is what the law is there for, is to deal with those problems. And I don't think it's being utilized to its capacity. I think perhaps we need to establish or look more at establishing a method of being able to respond rapidly to those situations so that they can be cut off at the pass before a tragedy does occur. And I think that we're very weak in that area, and that something more should be done to allow that to happen, or to make sure that it does happen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Al Elkins, next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'd like to speak, first of all, Madam Chair, to the bill, if I may, and the amendment second. We support both, and we're on record. There were questions earlier about the intent of the bill, and when we first started this process with the original bill, we were reinventing the wheel. Actually, we were not reinventing the wheel. We reinvented the whole vehicle, and it was confusing to everyone what our attempt was in the internet hunting portion of the what we were trying to do. So we regrouped. And what you see before you today, the ANGROS, is what we came up with, allowing the department to set rules regulating internet hunting and World Wide Web hunting. And that's the purpose of the bill. And in Mr. Anglin's testimony today, he said, and I quote, "However, the concept of hunting over the internet has never been requested for commission consideration and acceptance as a legal hunting method." That's where we're trying to get in the discussions with the commission, to allow us to ban internet hunting, but also to have discussions on to what extent we can ban it. In the original bill, we had a definition of hunting as with the direct or indirect use of a weapon, regardless of the means of controlling the weapon. And in relation to Representative Burley's question earlier this morning on this bill, that's where we wanted to get. We wanted, as an association, to get to the fact that even if you're sitting at your computer in Oregon and the ranch is somewhere else, that's illegal. I don't know if we can get there. I certainly would like to have that discussion during the rulemaking process so that that can occur, because to the Oregon Hunters Association, that is not ethical hunting. So, and Madam Chair, and I'm trying to answer Representative Burley's question. I'm not doing a very good job, but we had the same concerns that he voiced earlier in his question, and we hope to get there. It will depend upon what the attorneys tell us and all, but that was our original intent, to just stop the whole thing, no matter where you're sitting, no matter where the ranch is, that it's just not something we want anyone to be part of. So that's why we went with the rulemaking, because once we got into these discussions, we didn't think we'd ever get a bill passed. If I may now address the amendment, the Dash 5 amendments, we support the amendments. I was asked to visit with Senator Ferrioli 2 weeks ago about a number of issues. And to us, this amendment allows for local control, local opinions, local, this is what's happening in our area, we need to do this. It's not controlled by one or two counties in the state who are not affected by cougar or bear, but it allows the people within the areas where they are to vote, to make a choice. And that's what this is all about. In my meeting with Senator Ferrioli, he gave me he had a stack of petitions signed about 200 members of OHA from Grant County, asking him to do something about cougars and elk and deer populations and the diminishment of those populations in that area. Not Multnomah County, not Washington County, not any of the the urban counties, but the rural county of Grant County, they wanted some help. This amendment will do that. And that's what I think this amendment's all about, and that's why we support this amendment. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Elkin? You must have done perfectly. Thank you. Ron Hardis, do you want to come up? Good morning.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder. I apologize for not signing up. I was putting out a fire somewhere else. My testimony will be very brief. I think it's been fairly well covered with the Dash A amendments. One of the problems that we had was with agriculture, worried about would a trap be considered a remote device. And there were a couple other situations that were similar to that, and we felt that by giving the agency the authority to do this by rule, it would be a lot quicker and cleaner to get it done that way. We did work this exercise in the Senate quite a bit and never could come up with a resolution that was going to fit everyone. So that's the reason we went with the Dash A amendments. With regards to the Cougar, I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind about where I stand on Cougar. I no longer have my Cougar tire tie tack. They auctioned it off at one of the fundraisers one day. We have to do something. And quite obviously, the original bill that came before you doesn't have a lot of life. That would have been the solution. That would have given us the research. It would have given us the ability to do what has to be done to come up with a scientific answer. It's too late for that. These numbers are increasing. We know that. It's interesting that we do have a larger number of animals being harvested, quite obviously, because more of them are around and more people are seeing them. It's as easy as that. Just did want to mention this big money deal that it's supposed to be making for the agency. Price of tags went from $50 to $10. Tags have increased, yes, but the price of them went down by 500%, I guess, if my math is correct. So we would be in support of that amendment also.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Harder? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else signed up. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 389A and open a work session on Senate Bill 389A.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 389.
I have a motion from Representative Boquist to move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 389. Any discussion? Representative Hatz?
Thank you. I think we should try to be practical here. And if this bill is not amended, it passes out, goes to the floor probably in a week, and I'm guessing in one or two speeches, 5 minutes, goes to the governor's desk. If we put this amendment, regardless of where you stand on it, we all agree it's controversial. There's likely to be a minority report on this bill, and instead of going to the House floor in a week, it'll probably be there in 2 weeks. And then when it passes, it will now have to go back to the Senate for concurrence. And then I am guessing that it will not be concurred upon. It will go to a conference committee. And now we're at the end of June or 1st of July when a lot of the leadership thinks that's when we're going to adjourn. And my fear is everything will die. And even though this is a good bill, it doesn't rank up in the top priority of where a lot of the key bills are this session. And I just think if we're going to be practical about the Internet bill, we have to understand that by putting this amendment on here, it puts it in serious jeopardy. Okay, and that might not be a big concern here, but I think that is a reality. If this is a good bill, the amendment, the Dash 5, then why not just introduce that as a special permission to get that bill out and let it live or die on its own merits? So I just offer that up to say let's be a little more practical here.
I kind of want to answer that.
I mean, you're one of the sponsors of the Internet bill, and so I know you're concerned with that.
I'm very concerned with that, but I'm also very concerned about our cougar population management in this state, and we don't seem to be able to address those issues. We have tried. I have tried. So we've got to continue to try. So that's why we're doing this. Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair. I don't disagree with Representative Haas at all on the practicality, but
I see it on the exact opposite side. If I believe for 1 minute, and I personally believe based on the co-sponsors on the Cougar issue, we could move it right out of the House. And if I practically thought that it would be addressed in the Senate or by the executive branch, I would do what Representative Haas suggested. So practically speaking, I think this is the only way to get a discourse with the other parties that are involved.
Thank you. Representative Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to agree with Representative Haas, too, in that these are two separate issues, should stand alone. Believe me, since I've known about this amendment, I've jumped back and forth many a time on it. If I'd been near a phone a few times, I've been out of it totally. I get frustrated with the games sometimes that get played on trying to get things passed. But again, this is not totally inconsistent with where I voted in the past two sessions on Cougars, because there is a problem with Cougars. My discomfort level comes from Bears, which is also very on the record, that I have a problem dealing with the Bear issue. So it's really hard. I'm real concerned about losing the one bill, the original bill on this one. But I am going to support the amendment and hope that somehow we can work it out in the process.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. I just want you to know I share your concerns greatly. Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Haas. This does make passage of this bill more problematic. Possibly it won't pass, but that does not excuse me from doing what I think is the right thing. And the right thing is to control Cougars as soon as possible. If there's an opportunity, a chance of getting this bill passed, I'm going to be supportive of these amendments.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Anything else?
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Burley.
Yes.
Representative Haas.
No.
Representative Roblin.
Yes.
Representative Sumner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Smith.
Votes aye. We've moved the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 389. Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor.
Would the do pass?
With the do pass.
Would be adopted.
Do pass this case.
Okay. Got to check with Patrick. I have a motion from Representative Boquist to move Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Do I have any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Kapp?
No.
Representative Roblin?
Yes.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Smith.
Chair votes aye. We've moved Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Boquist will be the carrier. Thank you. I don't have anything else on the agenda. We are on the 24-hour notice, and we can call a work session within an hour. So watch the agendas. We'll try to get them out. I've tried to be very thoughtful about how we do that to work around our schedules. And we've moved our committee date party from next Wednesday to June 16th. So in case you got an email, save the date. It's now June 16th. Just so you know it, I want your wives and spouses and husbands and friends and your personal staff.
Glad to know it would be part of it. I know.
One of our other committee staff has been talking to me about that, and she asked that if any of the committee members have a conflict with the date of the 16th, that they can give me a call, and we can kind of work out another thing. But that's the plan. If everybody can make the 16th, I think that's the plan. The current plan is the Willamette Vineyards, or there's another country club that they're looking at as well.
I see. Well, we can determine the place. It's a Thursday. And as far as conflicts, we'll probably all have conflicts. So, thank you very much. We are adjourned.